The following recording was produced by the Queechy Church in Queechy, Vermont. For more information on the church, its activities, and resources, please visit us online at www.queechychurch.org.
Today's reading comes from 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 3, and then 13 to 25. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance, but as he who has called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Since it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. And if you call on him as Father who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile, knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. He was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in the last times for the sake of you, who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. And that ends the reading of the Word of God.
Thank you, Margaret. So last week, one of the things that we focused on, in light of the celebration of Christ's resurrection, is the way that the fear of death has been broken. The slavery, that controlling force that permeates our lives, perhaps even most powerfully when we're not aware of it, has been broken. Ernest Becker, in his book, The Denial of Death, describes this factor in this way. The fear of death must be present behind all of our normal functioning in order for an organism to be armed towards self-preservation. If you're not afraid of death, you will die. You will do something foolish. But the fear of death cannot be present constantly in one's mental functioning, or the organism could not function. If you really think about death, it will terrify you, and you will become paralyzed. So we can understand what seems like an impossible paradox. The ever-present fear of death and our normal biological functioning of our instincts of self-preservation, as well as our utter obliviousness to this fear in our conscious life, that is the slavery that we so normally operate under, but that Jesus frees us from by destroying death itself, his resurrection being the guarantee of that. And so this becomes transformed. And we can begin to see that even death itself will come to an end. It will not be an eternal reality. And so from there, we begin to look and say, how do we get there? What does it look like to live from this day until that day? And the scriptures over and over again describe what it means to know God by simply talking about the way or the path from the very beginning. The second book of the Bible is we call Exodus, which just means the way out. It was the way that God brought his people into salvation. That's what it's about. Very often you see the way of the man of God talked about when it's describing a prophet. Psalm 1 talks about the way of the righteous, how the Lord knows the path, the journey, the way that a righteous person goes and does not know the way of the wicked. In this case, we're not talking about cognitive categories. We're talking about what he loves and cherishes. Indeed, Christians were not initially called Christians. They were just Jewish people who followed the way of Jesus. Said, he's the one who's taking us on a new exodus, a new way. They were just called followers of the way. To be called a Christian was a put down. Oh, you're like that Jesus guy. And eventually they said, yeah, fair enough, you can call us that. And so we do to this day. But what does that day, what does that way look like? And we're looking at 1 Peter 1 because of his description of what it looks like to journey on until this final day. And there are three basic commands that he gives us here that we're going to look at. The first one being to hope. The second being to be holy. And the third, to love earnestly. So we're going to look at the way or the path of hope. We're going to look at the path of holiness. And then we're going to look at the path of love, our normal, arbitrary, three-point breakdown. But conveniently in this passage, there are three basic commands. So let's look at the first one, the way of hope. What do we mean when we talk about hope? Well, Peter's very practical. And if you read through the Gospels, you'll get that impression of him. He's a very practical, earthy man. And so I think it's helpful to get advice from Peter, who has been, he's been everywhere. He's made all the mistakes. And he says, here's what you need to do. Here is what you have to do if you're going to follow this way. And what he says is, gird up the loins of your mind. Translation that we're looking at talks about girding up the loins, preparing your minds for action. But literally, it's gird up your belt in your mind. That doesn't mean think about putting your pants on and getting a belt. I have to do that every day, make sure where's my belt. Want to make sure that I'm ready for the day. But it's an image. I mean, so you think about the day that he lived in. Most people, they didn't wear what we wear now. But they had the same problem that we do. If I needed to run a race, this would be terrible attire for that. It would be uncomfortable, and it would hinder my ability to run the race. They had the same problem in that day. Except where these clothes are maybe a little too tight. Hopefully not too tight. Their clothes might have been too loose. They would get tripped up in their clothing. And so what they would do is they would gather it up, and you know, we think we've invented all this fancy athletic wear. Their clothes were transformable. They could gather up their robes, their tunics, they could tie them up, and they put a belt around it, and all of a sudden now they're free to move. And so if in the course of your regular life you needed to chase down an animal, you need to chase down a kid, whatever it was, first thing you do, you get your belt and you get ready. And then you're free to act. So Peter takes this common, everyday sort of image in his time. We might almost say, put on your workout clothes, because it's time to work. You have work to do. So he says, gird up the loins of your mind. He's not talking about outward clothes at all. And that's why here it's translated, prepare your minds for action. He uses that literal phrase, gird up the belt, and then adds, of your mind. So get ready. You are going to have to direct your attention, and it's going to take effort. It's going to take energy. And this is a participle. It's a conditional word. This isn't even the main command that he's come to yet. So gird up the loins of your mind. Get ready. You're going to have to think and think hard. And then he says, being sober-minded. This one's not that hard to explain. He's simply saying, keep your mind clear. Don't be intoxicated. Don't be distracted. Keep your minds clear. You're going to have to think hard, and you're going to need all the clarity in the world to do this. You've got to get ready, and here's why. You need to hope fully. Our English translation says, set your hope fully, but just literally just hope fully in the grace that comes from Jesus Christ. If I can phrase this in another way, he says, don't be lazy. This is not rest time. This is work time. Don't get distracted. Don't become intoxicated. You have something important to do with your mind, and this is what it is. Set your hope fully on the grace that comes from God through Jesus Christ. And if you don't do that, you're going to get caught up in something else. You can't help it. Your heart is going to set its hope on something. It's going to say, here's how I'm going to get through the day. Here's how I'm going to get through the week. Here's how I'm going to get through the year. And something is going to capture your heart. And it won't be the grace that comes from God. If you want to live in God's grace, if you recognize that his grace has come to us in Jesus Christ and you want it, you've got to set your mind on it, or your mind will be distracted by something else. Peter's very practical. People, get ready. Get your mind ready. Keep it clear and focus it. And then he goes on later in the passage to double down on this and say, you have every reason to do this. What do I mean? In verses 20 and 21, he says, we live at the best possible time to do this. We have every opportunity to do this. He says, he, Jesus, was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in the last times. Meaning God has always planned what he was going to do, but it wasn't clear until now, this time where we live between Jesus' resurrection and the last day. He's made it manifest in this time. Why did he make it manifest in this time? For the sake of you, who through him are believers in God. God chose the timing of when it would be clear of how he would save people, how he would extend his grace to broken and sinful people, so that you who live between the time of his resurrection and his second coming, would know it. That means the people beforehand did not know it. It was not clear and open the way that it is for us now. You live in a special time. For the sake of you who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory so that your faith and hope are in him. Set your minds fully on him because he made it clear to you so that you would have access to it. You who live now. This is a privilege people who lived before did not have in this way. So he says, take advantage of it. Set your mind on it. And this hope is something that is future-oriented, and that's crucial. Because he's going to go on to talk about how do you live when that day hasn't come yet. It's difficult. And so it's important for us to know we are hoping about something that comes to us in the future. The grace that will be brought to you. Hasn't God given us grace? Of course you would not be breathing without his grace. You would not know his grace without his grace. But you don't have the experience of all of his grace. If you think you do, you're outrageously naive. Difficult things are coming. But most of us know we are not experiencing all of his grace. And that's okay. But boy, aren't we hoping for that day when death and suffering come to an end, when our own sins finally come to an end. That's the grace that will come to us that we're setting our hope in. And it's something that we grow. Do you see how he says, put your hope fully? If you know the grace of God, you're hoping in him, but probably not fully. It's a capacity that you can grow in. And Peter says, hope fully in that grace. Don't just be content with where you are now. There's more for you to know and a way for you to grow into it. And he starts this all by saying, therefore. Right? We started with verse 3, but when we come to verse 13, therefore, preparing your minds for action. And the question you always have to ask is, what's the therefore, therefore? And essentially, verse 3 sums it up, because he has already shown you such tremendous grace. You have every reason to hope in him. And you may even notice some similarity, if you're familiar with Paul's letters, that this is exactly what Paul talks about in Romans 12. After 11 chapters of explaining the good news of Jesus Christ and interacting with its Jewish context, he then says, therefore. Peter just gets right to the point. Chapter 1, therefore. He's a very practical man. But they both say the same thing. Your mind has to be changed. It has to be set. It has to grow in fixing its attention and its hope on God. And this, honestly, if we take it seriously, is something that is impossible. In fact, if you are wrestling with this idea right now, what would it look like to hope fully in God? You're probably already becoming aware of the fact that you don't hope fully in God. And you're thinking, oh my goodness, I have some small idea of the internal resistance that's even in my own heart, much less the world that I live in. How could I possibly get there? How could I possibly live like that, like my hope was fully in God? Well, it's impossible. Humanly speaking, that's impossible, but it's a gift that God gives us. David Pallison, in talking about this journey from the day of Christ's resurrection to the day of his return, it's a journey that theologically we call sanctification. It's a very discouraging topic in one sense, but a very hopeful one in another. He talks about it this way. He says, we love gazelles. Graceful leaps make for a great testimony to God's wonder-working power. And we like steady and predictable. If I work at this, it'll get better. and I know how it'll get better, and I can chart its progress. Right? We want a spiritual Excel sheet. We want a spiritual graph that'll show us how we're doing and how to take the next step. It seems to vindicate our efforts in making Christian life work in a business-like manner. But in fact, there is, and this is good news, there is no formula, no secret, no technique, no program, and no truth that guarantees the speed, distance, or time frame. On the day you die, you will still be somewhere in the middle of your journey. So how in the world is that encouraging? Because it's not required that you reach perfection first. It's not required. It's a duty and a delight we have in the meantime. Listen to how he talks about this. You'll still be somewhere in the middle, but further along. When we lengthen the battle, we realize that our business has everything to do with the direction we are facing. That's the issue. Where am I looking? What have I set my mind on? That's the real question. God manages to work his wonder-working glory in and through every scenario. I was actually present when David Pallison spoke these words. And he described a situation where sometimes you are fighting to set your hope on God, to change your behavior, and you're making no progress. You're just sitting there saying, I'm a stupid sinner who can't do anything right, but I'm looking at him. And that's good. That's what you're called to do. To look and to long in that direction. Everything else is God's business. That's good news. That's the path of hope. That's the path of the gospel. God is doing it. And you can look to him. And you can invest yourself in him. And indeed, Christian, you must. You must set your hope fully on him. And Peter goes on. He's very practical. He says, now it's not just a mind game. It is a mind game. You have to get your mind ready to play this game. But there's more to it. Set your hope fully, but then he says, be holy. And I think we have a hard time with this. Culturally, holiness? Where is that in our culture? Actually, I could go into this. We're very concerned with purity in our culture. But Peter is very practically minded here. He's not just being esoteric and religious when he talks about being holy. No, what he says is your mind needs to be transformed, but also you live in a polluted environment. You live somewhere that's just constantly grabbing your attention and pulling you away, and you have to focus on keeping all of those distractions away from you. Remember last week I talked about how there's no angel on one shoulder and a demon on the other. It's just two demons who are working together to distract you. That's the world we live in. So what do you do? Well, Peter talks here, he talks about the hope that you have, and he contrasts it with the passions of ignorance. The word that he uses here, the word that he uses is epithumia. And I say that just to say, thumia is passion or desire, and epi means over. So that's why it's translated passions, an over desire. Not just a desire for something. Of course you have desires for things. You want to eat. You want to drink. You want to be happy. You want to have friends. You want good things. Of course you do. But what he's warning you against is when you did not know the passion of your ignorance, when you were ignorant of the grace that comes to you through Jesus Christ, your desires were over desires. And they ruled you, and they absorbed you. You were a slave. Now, I had a friend in college who grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, the home of Coca-Cola, and he loved Coca-Cola. And I mean, I love Coca-Cola, but I can't drink it. It's not good for you, as it turns out, sadly, or, you know, not much. Can't drink too much of it. You can't drink too much of anything. But he loved Coca-Cola. I was like, oh, I love Coca-Cola. No, not compared to him. Went out to dinner with him a few times in a group of friends, and they would come and they would ask, what do you want to drink? And he'd say, oh, I'd love a Coke. And they'd say, is Pepsi okay? Just water, thank you. I was stunned. I'd never seen anybody devoted to a drink like that. It blew my mind. What, you really love Coke. You really do. No, he didn't. because he worked at Coca-Cola one summer, just manning phones, you know, just summer job in high school. And he would get calls, and he would direct calls. And he got a call from a lady who said, "I'm just calling to tell you that I love Coca-Cola." Okay, if you're doing customer service, you get all kinds of interesting calls. This was an interesting call. She said, "I just called to tell you how much I love Coca-Cola." I said, "Okay, you're going out of your way to call the company to say, okay, I believe you." She said, no, "I love Coca-Cola. I drank so much, my body swelled, my health suffered. The doctors put me on a limit of 2 liters a day from now on." "Okay, lady, you love Coke too much." Largely, Coke is a good thing. But if the desire masters you, it destroys you. It's a passion, an over-desire that consumes you. Doctors had to intervene to keep this woman alive because she couldn't stop drinking Coca-Cola. But you could drink enough water to kill you. There's nothing that if it became a passion wouldn't kill you. This is what Peter's concerned about. Why do you have to be holy? Because you used to live in a time where you didn't know the grace of God, and your desire even for good things consumed you, and you still live in that world. Even if you now know his grace, you have to be holy. Not, as I said, in a weird esoteric religious way the way we normally think of it. He just says you are living in a polluted world, and it will pollute you. It'll cloud your view. It will change your behavior. In other words, Peter's saying you need to be unencumbered. You need to not be tangled up. Hebrews 12 talks about throwing off the sin that so easily entangles. Let us run with endurance the race before us. You have a path to follow. And you can't afford to be tripping your way down the path. Not in the sense that you have to get to the end to qualify. No. The path is the result of God qualifying you through Jesus Christ. But if you love him, do you want to be tripped up all the time? No, if you do a real spiritual calculation, no, I can't afford that. In fact, if we understand what Peter is saying, you have to deny yourself your desires so that you can have something better. You have to be sober and clear-minded. In other words, the way to think about being holy is, what is it that when it captures your attention, you don't give thanks to God for it? It so captures your attention that he's gone. And your desire is all that there is. Every time that happens, you have to stop and say, this is an over-desire. But I know better. I know where true goodness is. And I've got to stop it. This could be things that are good, hobbies, TV, movies, games, food, fun, all good things, theoretically anyway. There's some bad stuff there, but can you give thanks? If you watch a good movie or TV show, do you say, "God, thank you. I didn't need to be entertained. We've created a world where there's entertainment." Or are you just, "That's all there is. Oh, I want more. I've fallen in the show hole. I don't know what to watch on Netflix next. There's a hole in my life." No. That's a sign. You've been clouded. You've been polluted. You need to stop. "I can't do that. I cannot afford this. I am losing out on good things because this passion, this over-desire is taking over." It could be things that are just flat out wrong. You know they're wrong. So you've got the good, but you've got the bad. Directing your anger at people, manipulating people around you, lust, pornography, theft, you know they're wrong. But we have this tendency of saying, "Well, sometimes there are circumstances that justify me doing these things. They just come up a lot for me," as it turns out. No, these completely take over. So it could be good things. It could be the bad things that cloud. Those tend to be more obvious. But that we also live in a world. This is why Peter says you have to be holy. You live in a world that tends to that kind of evil. What do I mean? How much are you on Twitter? The debate in our time is, this is a toxic place. How do we clean it up? I don't know. Nobody seems to know. And if you live there, it will pollute you and control you. Are you always in your mind in a fight with somebody? Our public world wants you to be in a fight in your mind with somebody all the time, because there's nothing that gets your attention like what those stupid people over there are doing. Right? You thought of somebody right when I said that. It was not hard to do. You just get your attention just like that. That's why the medium is the message. It doesn't matter who the stupid people are. We live in a world where our public life just wants you to be concerned about it. There are stupid people out there, and they're bad, and they hate you, and you should hate them. That's the real message, not who the people are or the specific events. You live in a world like that. It is constantly grabbing at your attention. It's trying to force you into a mold. It really, in the end, doesn't care whether you're liberal, progressive, conservative, libertarian, as long as you want to fight. And Christian, you can't afford to live there, because the grace of God is not there. It's coming. It's coming to you. And you can't sit here and fight imaginary battles just because the pressures around you are drawing you in. You can't do that. Why is everything an emergency in our public life? Why is everything outrageous? Why the constant superlatives? Why is it the latest, the worst, never seen before? It's because you're being conned. You're being tricked into living in an imaginary world of evil. I don't say that lightly. That is what is happening. It's what's been happening for thousands of years. We just have outrageous technology to enable us to take this to the nth degree. You can't live there. Whether it's TV, whether it's the internet, whether it's newspapers, whether it's just the way that you chat with your friends about these things. Christian, that is not where life is. You have to be holy and not polluted in this way. The medium is the message, and the message is react. Be subject to your emotions and to anybody who pulls the strings for those emotions. Be provoked. I say to you, Christian, do not be provoked unless it's to love and good deeds. You cannot afford to live that way. And then we've talked about this at other times. There's the good, there's the bad, and then there's the ugly. The intervening verses we didn't read. We live in a life of suffering, and it has a way of distracting us. And so Peter says, all the more you have to be disciplined so that suffering can turn you to the grace of God rather than away from it. What comes into your heart and mind that obscures God's grace? The call to holiness is the call to say, no. I will not allow it. And Christian, you're able to do this. Not perfectly. That would be hopeless. But you can set your hope fully in God and begin to say no to anything that clouds that hope. That's the second part of the path. The third part, what's it all for? The motivation, the path of love. Peter says to love earnestly, to love from the heart. So a holy life is a life of discipline, not to prove how much better you are than everyone else, which is another message that's going on in our public life. You should not care whether you're better than anyone else, or if anyone else is better than you, or how you measure up, or how good the food looks when you take the picture and you post it, or any of that. None of that should matter. I'm not saying you can't post pictures of food. I don't understand it, but it's fine. But you shouldn't be consumed with being better than other people or showing off. That's not what holiness is for. But again, the medium is the message. What is the medium of the gospel? And Peter says it's love. You are holy so that you can hope and so that you can love. That's the reason. The gospel's medium is a community of love, and so it makes a community of love when it is proclaimed. And the community of love cherishes that gospel. You can look at, and Peter talks about us being exiles on earth, so you can draw a parallel. If you observe an immigrant community, a first-generation immigrant community in particular, you will see a community that intensely values one another because there's pressure from the outside. And they know instinctively, we cannot survive if we do not love one another. And so they're constantly supporting one another. They're very affectionate about their people and their way of doing things because it can't be taken for granted. But in the gospel, we are to have an affection for one another, not in opposition to any other culture or group, but because that is exactly what the gospel is. We live in exile, not in opposition to the people around us, but certainly in opposition to the evil age in which we live that puts pressure on us. So it's not an in-group, out-group dynamic. It's simply, if you understand the gospel and you know the love of God, you love it. And you want to practice it and participate in it. And to do that, your hope has to be fixed. You have to be holy and as unpolluted as you can be so that you're not hindered. Right? Anything that you want to do that matters takes effort and attention. They say it takes 10,000 hours of practice to achieve mastery in something. I don't think it's that simple. But it at least gets us the idea, where are you going to get 10,000 hours from? It's not just given to you. You got to find it. You got to make it happen. You want to run a marathon? I don't, but some people do. Well, there are things you're going to have. You can't eat this and you can't do that. And you can't use your time that way. You've got to focus it. You want to enter into a new career? You want to begin a course of study? You have to focus. You have to say no to other things. In the same way, holiness allows us to live a life of love with one another. Why is that so crucial? Love doesn't come easily. It doesn't come naturally. Love is real when it is pure. That's what Peter talks about here. To be purified so that we can have genuine brotherly affection. The word Philadelphia. And how do you get there? You love one another earnestly from the heart. That's how you get there. Love is real when it's pure, when it's not distracted by love for something else, or when it's a mercenary love that's just trying to get something different out of the other person. It actually enjoys and loves the other person purely. That's when you know you're experiencing and practicing real love. C.S. Lewis talked about this dynamic of love in this way. We're often afraid that heaven is a bribe, that if we make it our goal, then we won't be disinterested. So that's not the way that it works. That's not the way that love works. You're not just being holy and hoping things work out. No, you want something real. If you're a Christian, you want God's love and blessing and grace and a life free of pain and sin and fear and evil and injustice. We want those things desperately. And it's not wrong to want them. But he says this, heaven offers nothing a mercenary soul can desire. It's safe to tell the pure of heart they shall see God, for only the pure in heart really want to. There are rewards that don't sully the motives. A man's love for woman's not mercenary because he wants to marry her, nor is love for poetry mercenary because he wants to read it, or his love of exercise less disinterested because he wants to run and leap and walk. Love by its nature seeks to enjoy its object. This is the other way to think about holiness. To what end? To set your hope fully. But also, you can't love if you're encumbered, if you're tripped up, if the over-desires are coming between you and what you love, God himself and one another. Hoping in God's grace means living in it so purely and affectionately that you also love his people, who are not as good as he is. We know that. None of us is a perfect reflection of him, not even close. And finally, the gospel is worth this effort. It is a hope worth living and dying for. Peter says to conduct yourselves in this time of exile with fear. Why? Because the one that you call Father is also the judge of the earth. So, well, this all sounded good, but now I'm supposed to be afraid? What does this mean? God has become our Father without ceasing to be our judge. To become a child of God necessarily means loving him as Father and judge, and so respecting him. It means not being casual about God, but taking him very seriously. So seriously that if anything intervenes between you and him, you get rid of it. You keep your mind clear and ready to focus on him. Because Christian, he has taken you very seriously. So seriously that he gives you new life at the cost of his own son's life. That's how seriously he has taken you. How precious the purchase of your life and the grace that is to come is. He's taken you so very deeply seriously. He's worth you also taking him seriously in every aspect of life. You are no longer going to be judged by any standard. You're not going to be evaluated. On the last day, he's not going to say, don't know if you're good enough. No, you're free. You are actually free. And if he is your father, then you love him. And you know he's worth your best effort to know him and hope in him. And so to conclude, I want to ask a couple of questions. One, are you on this journey? Do you know the grace well enough to say, I want to know it better? That I'm longing for the day when it comes with him. Are you on that journey? Have you been born again to a living hope? Secondly, are you journeying now? Do you recognize that you are on a path from that day of resurrection to the day of ultimate resurrection, when even the earth and the heavens themselves will be made new and our bodies will be made new? Are you trying to move down that path? Are you proactive and invested, purifying yourself, resisting the outside pressures so that you can be free to hope and to love? Finally, are you journeying with joy? This maybe makes it the hardest. Are you doing it with joy? Saying, he's worth it. He's worth whatever I suffer and lose. He's worth whatever I have to say no to in order to see him more clearly. And that's good. That's good. Christ lived in this world of sorrow with us. With joy. He was happy to deny himself so that he could take you seriously, so that he could welcome you in to the life of God. Let us pray. Heavenly Father, it is good news that we will die imperfect. At least it's good news when we remember that we're saved by your grace and not by how far or how fast we journey towards it. We thank you for this gospel that sets us free, that gives us hope, that gives us the power to focus more fully on it and to love one another. Indeed, would you cause it to abound among us? For we ask in Christ's name. Amen.